Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top, Oxford Bank Thrusts South into Triangle. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Oxford. Given its nearly $24 billion in bank deposits, the Raleigh-Cary Metro is where Thomas Combs wants to be doing business. The CEO of Union Bank and Trust in Oxford, north of Raleigh, has opened a loan production office, or LPO, in Cary that is breaking even after only 5 months. Now Combs is opening another LPO, this one in North Raleigh, even as he sketches out more ambitious plans. We won't compete with the BB&Ts, the B of A's, and the Wells Fargo's, says Combs, but we will compete for those customers who really want to know who their bank president is. If the near-term goals work out, Combs has a second set of plans in preparation. Union Bank, he says, should commit itself to developing from 5 to 7 Wake County branches over the next 3 to 5 years. Some will probably have to be constructed from scratch. Others might be set up in existing space. It'll be a combination, says Combs, who plans to pay for his initial expansion moves with existing assets. If a capital raise is needed, the Granville County Bank will approach the investors in about 24 months, he says. Meanwhile, Combs is busy expanding and reorganizing his board to forge additional links to the Triangle market. The latest move came in late January with the addition of Steve Zaytown, an employee benefits firm owner and a founding board member of Crescent State Bank, to the bank's board in Cary. I was flattered to be asked to serve, says Zaytown. Union Bank has that same community bank flavor that Crescent did when it first opened. I think there is a real need for that in the southern Wake County market. Launched in April 2006, Union was turning profitable just as the worst of the downturn was hitting, but it did not lose ground because of it. Combs, who came out of BB&T, and the other executives around him, either BB&T or First Citizens vets, say that all learned their trade by following conservative banking principles. Applying those lessons to the startup has meant that Union Bank's loan portfolio, real estate and otherwise, has held up well. As of September 30, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the bank had total assets of $205 million, loans of $181 million, 5 branch offices, and was posting a profit of nearly $2 million through the first 9 months of 2012. To run his Cary LPO, Combs hired former Crescent Bank executive Larry Holt. For North Raleigh, which is opening in the North by North Hills building on Six Forks Road, former Capital Bank chief banking officer David Morgan has been brought in. The other offices will get off the ground, Combs says, as he can locate the banking talent to open them. Raleigh-Cary is one of the fastest-growing areas in the country, he says. It's a bubbling cauldron, is how North Carolina Bankers Association President Thad Woodard describes it, one of the most competitive places on the planet for banking. And Combs wants a piece of it. We feel like we can get 5,000 customers in Wake County, he says. Now, the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is in a black box. At the very top, there's a red line across the top that labels it as cover story. And within this area, there are actually two articles. The first article on the left side, first at the top, has a large picture looking down into a store, a sporting goods store, of people shopping. And under that is the headline in bold black lettering. Outdoors, here we go. Bass Pro Shops, Dick's, Gander Mountain, all to be part of battle in specialty space. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Cary. When Dick's Sporting Goods started developing a new store concept around the Field & Stream brand name, one of the first places it committed to open was at a new shopping center being built in West Cary. A week after the Field & Stream store announcement, Springfield, Missouri-based Bass Pro Shops declared that it would open a store in Cary. With these announcements, coupled with a Gander Mountain store that opened in nearby Morrisville in October, outdoorsy types in the Triangle soon will be awash in shopping options. I think all of them are making an effort to expand their audiences, says Abbott Goodwin, a partner with the shopping center group retail brokerage firm in Raleigh. And the moves come near to populating the Triangle retail landscape with all the big box outdoors players. Nearly. Missing is Cabela's, which has in recent months started searching again for its first site in North Carolina. The Sidney, Nebraska-based retailer announced in mid-January that it is opening a 100,000-square-foot store in Greenville, South Carolina, which will be one of its first stores in the southeastern U.S., but real estate sources say the company still wants a store in North Carolina. Dick's and Field & Stream. Dick's Field & Stream concept stores are just beginning to launch in select markets. The store planned at Parkside Town Commons in West Cary will be among the first ground-up buildings. Parkside Town Commons is under construction at the intersection of O'Kelly Chapel Road and NC-55 near the exit ramp for the Triangle Expressway in Cary. Dick's has been a major licensee of Field & Stream brand for many years, using it for a full line of technical equipment for fishing, hunting, camping, and paddle sports. Then in September, Dick's took the relationship a step further by acquiring the intellectual property rights to the trademarks in Field & Stream's hunting, fishing, camping, and paddle categories. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. A representative of Westport, Connecticut-based Field & Stream referred questions about the deal and the new store concept to Dick's. A representative of Dick's did not return calls for comment. According to news reports, the company is planning to open a Field & Stream store near Pittsburgh in a space that Dick's recently vacated after moving its traditional sporting goods store that was in the space to a larger two-story facility. In a conference call with analysts in November, Dick's CEO Edward Stack noted that the company's investment in the Field & Stream name would be accretive to the business and that Dick's will not have to pay any fees going forward. Bass Pro Shops. The store that Bass Pro Shops will open on Harrison Avenue in Cary will not be one of the mega-sized outdoor world stores like the company operates in Concord, Myrtle Beach, Atlanta, or Orlando. Called a Sportsman's Center store, it will be smaller but still have a showroom for boats and aquarium stocked with native fish and much of the same equipment, clothing, and other outdoor-related items that the big stores carry. Bass Pro Shops is taking over a 105,000-square-foot building currently occupied by Carolina Pottery in the Harrison Square Shopping Center across from SAS Campus in Cary. Bass Pro Shops spokeswoman Katie Mitchell says the store is expected to open in late 2013 or early 2014. The new store project will not impact the 18,000 square feet of small shops adjacent to the Carolina Pottery building or any of the restaurants or service retailers located on out parcels along Harrison Avenue. That's good news for Emily Biggs, owner of the South of France Furniture Studio, who recently signed a 2-year lease for space in Harrison Square and opened for business last week. People are very excited about the Bass Pro Shops coming, Biggs says. A lot of men will be shopping there, and the women can come down here for our classes to learn about faux finishing. And the second article in this front page cover story section, also written by Amanda Jones Hoyle, has the headline, Smaller Stores Count Service as Advantage. And this story has a dateline of Raleigh. The way Chuck Millsap sees it, it doesn't matter how many more paddles, waders, or tents that big box retailers like Bass Pro Shops or Gander Mountain can carry, their staff likely still couldn't tell you where the fish are biting or how to get to the best places for a hike. From the beginning, we've always believed something magical happens when you go outside, says Millsap, president and minister of culture for Raleigh-based Great Outdoor Provision Company. Great Outdoor Provision is one of the largest independent outdoor sporting goods retailers in the state, with 7 stores scattered from Charlotte to Wilmington. The company employs about 130 people. Each of Great Outdoor Provision stores, much like a store for REI or another independent like Tobacco Road Outdoors and Apex, may average only about 10,000 square feet in retail floor space compared to a 50,000 square foot Gander Mountain store or a 100,000 square foot Bass Pro Shop store. We could fit all of our stores inside one Bass Pro Shop, Millsaps laughs, but the small shops can make up for their relatively small size with their knowledge of the products and in their service to the customer, he says. It's one thing to find an exciting product, but it's another thing to learn how to use it, he says. It's that personal connection that hopefully we are able to provide. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, SMT's crew sent scurrying when dome went dark. When the lights went out in the Superdome in New Orleans during the Super Bowl, folks with sports media technology had to run, literally, says the Durham Company's CEO, Gerard Hall. You don't see that every day on a regular football game, much less the Super Bowl, he notes of the 35-minute outage. And Hall would know his company provides graphics and effects for events ranging from the Masters golf tournament to regular season National Football League games. But when the lights went out, so did the nine SMT-powered cameras on the field. The fact that it's a live football game, we need to get this up. It's an emergency, he recalls, but SMT rehearses for contingencies, and in Hall's history with sporting events, no other event has tested that rehearsal process quite like this. We had quite a little army of people running from location to location to get those cameras, he says of reactivating the cameras after the outage. Hall's team prioritized focusing on three main field cameras, the cameras at both 35-yard lines and a camera at the 100-yard line, and it wasn't as simple as just turning the camera on. Each camera had to calibrate, he says. We executed exceptionally. Nobody missed a beat. And it could have been worse, noting that half the stadium remained with power. Had both power feeds gone out, that would have been a nightmare. Social business strategy is just one piece of the IBM puzzle, says IBM's general manager of social business, Alistair Rennie. But it's something business leaders need to know about, particularly those at C-level, says Rennie, adding that social media within an enterprise is a growing force to be taken advantage of. In a Q&A with ZDNet, Rennie said that traditional business models, such as human resources and customer support, fly out the window when considering what social analytics can do. Technology allows companies to make smarter predictions about who to hire so they can put together better work teams. Turns out Biz has pretty good peripheral vision. After a long, hard day at work, Biz decided to stop off at the Chick-fil-A near the streets at South Point in Durham and noticed a familiar face through the window of the restaurant while driving up to the drive-thru window. After a double take, Biz realized it was UNC Chapel Hill basketball star James Michael McAdoo. But just to make sure, the question was offered up to a Chick-fil-A employee, "Is that who I think it is?" UNC, James Michael McAdoo? Yes, sir, was the reply. Cool. But Biz just has one question. Why was he in Blue Devil Country? When Duke University students pick their locales for study abroad, they're a decidedly predictable cohort. Of the 576 Dukies who studied abroad in the fall of 2012, a total of 412 picked Europe, reports The Chronicle, Duke's student newspaper. Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom topped the list. In fact, only three non-European countries made the top 10, Australia, Costa Rica, and South Africa. Morrisville-based Oxygen Biotherapeutics is teaming up with the U.S. Army. The company has signed a research agreement with the Army's Institute of Surgical Research to explore the potential effects of OBI's OxyCite on platelet function. The research will complement work already funded by a Department of Defense grant to broaden the safety profile of using the molecules to treat patients with traumatic brain injury, an indication for which OBI is already conducting Phase 2 trials overseas. While in town to crack wise for thousands of admirers at DPAC on February 2nd, comedian Jerry Seinfeld became a fan himself of Durham's organic transit. The Porsche collecting star slipped inside one of the groundbreaking people-powered OTVs, organic transit vehicles, and posed for pics, says CEO Rob Cotter. Like lots of people, when Jerry saw what we were doing, he was overcome with curiosity. He was in town for a show at DPAC, but when I saw him, he was with a couple of friends just staring at our storefront on East Chapel Hill Street. So inside, he went to check out the little machines. I can say without qualification, he loved it, says Cotter. Jerry is a Porsche collector and said our prototypes reminded him of the earliest generation of Porsches from the 40s. As a biking enthusiast, sports car aficionado, and someone concerned for the environment, he was very excited and was amazed at all we accomplished in the past 10 months. Bill Carey has returned to the law firm Brooks Pierce in Raleigh after a 9-month stint as general counsel for the North Carolina Department of Environmental and Natural Resources. Carey joins Bill Ross at the firm. Ross was DENR's director under former Governor Mike Easley. Meanwhile, new DENR director John Skvarla has brought on Lacey Presnell as the department's new general counsel. Presnell was previously an attorney with Burns, Day, and Presnell in Raleigh. Registration is open for the 2013 season for Camp Corral, a free week-long summer camp for military children ages 8 to 15. The camp, a charity function of Raleigh-based Golden Corral, gives priority to children of wounded, disabled, or fallen military families. Golden Corral founded the camp in 2011 with a single session at a 4-H camp in Ellerbe. In 2012, the camp was expanded to include 8 additional camp locations and provided for 1,500 campers. For the summer of 2013, Camp Corral has expanded to 18 camps in 14 states, Arizona, Arkansas, California, 2 in Colorado, 2 in Florida, Georgia, Kansas, Kentucky, Illinois, 3 in North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas, and Virginia to provide a week of a lifetime for more than 2,200 military children. Campers will experience traditional camp activities, swimming, canoeing, fishing, horseback riding, archery, a ropes course, exploring nature trails, cookouts and crafts, plus lots of outside adventures. While Camp Corral is free for the kids, parents are responsible for transportation to and from camp. Registration can be done online at the Golden Corral website. Contributing to Biz were staffers Cameron Snipes, Lauren Onsorge, and Chris Bagley. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one has the headline, Audit Finds Massive Spending on Contractors. This article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. Tucked away in a state audit that reveals administrative cost overruns in the state's Medicaid system is a figure that shows nearly half of all administrative costs incurred by the Division of Medical Assistance were in the form of payments to private contractors. In the fiscal year that ended June 30, 2012, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services paid $781 million in Medicaid administrative costs. Of that, about $257 million was incurred by the Division of Medical Assistance, of which $120 million, or 46.7%, went to private contractors. Some experts say that's a significant amount of outsourcing, to the point that it contributes to the cost overruns. I think there are excessive administrative costs because they are not managing these relationships very well, says Rob Hanfield, a graduate professor of supply chain management at NC State's Poole College of Management. That falls partly back on the state, he says. Contracts with outsourcers can get very specific and detailed, but at the end of the day, there needs to be a well-defined scope of work, he says. The state needs to make sure it gives contractors good direction so they can perform properly. Auditors agreed. It is always important for a state government to exercise sound management practices with regard to the contract services, according to the audit. But it becomes even more critical when almost half of the administrative expense is made up of contract payments. Choosing good vendors and contractors on the front end is important to avoiding cost overruns on the back end. That could mean not simply going with the vendor that offers the lowest price when the contract goes out to bid. You can find the lowest price, but are you getting the best value? Hanfield asked rhetorically. Of course, that becomes difficult to sell to the taxpayer, so the entire process must be transparent, Hanfield says. That's when watchdogs demand to understand why a particular contractor was used despite a higher cost. The state can supply reasons for choosing a higher quality vendor. That's easier said than done, says Ari Lewin, a graduate professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. He says finding vendors for complicated systems like Medicaid requires skill. So what happens is they are treated like the old procurement process, like you're buying coffee cups. It doesn't make sense, Lewin says. Indeed, the Medicaid budget in North Carolina reached more than $14 billion in 2012, an increase of 23% over the past 4 years. There is an incredible amount of work associated with managing these contracts, Hanfield says. In response to the audit, DHHS Secretary Dr. Aldana Woos has promised the division would implement a system to track contract requirements and expenditures on a weekly basis. Under no circumstances will contractors be allowed to exceed the budgeted contract amounts without an approved amendment to the contract. Finding good contractors is not something that private industries are good at either, says Lewin. The results of a study he conducted will be published in an upcoming issue of Duke's quarterly CFO magazine. In the study, he finds that only about 20% of private companies are effective at outsourcing. Essentially, businesses and government don't develop a good enough corporate strategy around the outsourcing model and incur waste. Government might not be good at it, Lewin says, but just remember, companies are not that good at it either. And our next article is in the middle of this page, has a black border around it. Inside that border at the top, there's a picture of a man wearing a black T-shirt standing in front of a lot of kegs piled up behind him. The caption reads, Mark Doble heads up Aviator Brewing Company, a growing operation in Fuquay Varina. And then under that, there's the headline, and it has some unlabeled bottles. They look like beer bottles around it. And it says in bold black lettering, Brew Local, Triangle Microbreweries Expand into Other States. Now, this article is written by Chris Bagley with a Dateline of Raleigh. 2 years into a major growth spurt, the Triangle's upstart microbrewing industry is now overflowing into neighboring states. Local breweries have started distributing in Atlanta, Washington, D.C., and areas of Virginia, South Carolina, Kentucky, and Florida just in the last couple of months, mostly to bars and restaurants. Local breweries distributing out of state, Lone Rider Brewing Company, Aviator Brewing Company, and Carolina Brewery are among the Triangle's four largest. Brewers say their gradually expanding brewing capacity has allowed them to move into new markets. Capacity has generally been limited by financing and capital rather than by business decisions based on customer demand, brewers say. Most breweries in North Carolina are just bursting at the seams, says Wynn Bassett, executive director of the North Carolina Brewers Guild. Capacity is the main factor. At least one of the breweries, Lone Rider, brought in a handful of equity investors as it bought new tanks and fermenters and expanded into neighboring buildings in Raleigh's Westgate neighborhood. It added one 80-barrel brewing tank in December, co-founder and CEO Sumit Vora says. The brewery's output will go from about 11,000 barrels in 2012 to at least 18,000 this year, he says. Several smaller local breweries are forecasting similar expansions. More than 30 bars and restaurants in the Atlanta area began tapping Lone Rider kegs in the final weeks of 2012, Vora says. Mark Doble, who owns Aviator in Fuquay Varina, says he has sealed up distribution deals in Lexington, Kentucky, Danville, Virginia, Columbia, South Carolina, and Washington, D.C. since December. Carolina Brewery, which has brew pubs in Chapel Hill and Pittsburgh, began to distribute in South Carolina last year. The fourth large local brewery, Big Boss Brewing Company of Raleigh, distributes throughout North Carolina but hasn't expanded into neighboring states. While state lines matter less than they did in years immediately following Prohibition, they do play into the patchwork of local distributors that dot the nation due to widely differing state laws. Entering even a small metropolitan area usually means hammering out details of a contract with a new distribution company. Prohibition killed off thousands of small breweries across the U.S., and their numbers have started to recover only in the last 15 years. Almost all of the Triangle's microbreweries were founded after 2005, when North Carolina lifted its 6% cap on beer's alcohol content, though most have offerings both above and below that former threshold. Meanwhile, South Carolina and a few other states still prohibit brewing companies from distributing their own elixirs, an obstacle for the handful that prefer self-distribution as a means of quality control. The District of Columbia is a sort of exception that proves the rule, Doble says. Congress has historically handled many of the local matters that are elsewhere left up to state governments. There are really no beer laws there, so it's great, he says, half in jest. It's like the Wild West up there. As it happens, microbrewers' branding often makes use of Wild West imagery and other pre-prohibition history and mythology. Lone Rider, for example, uses the tagline, "Ales for Outlaws," and has styled each of its beers around a fictional Wild West character. The label on its pale ale bears the figure of a sheriff type known as the Peacemaker. Lone Rider is breathing new life and color into those characters as it expands in Atlanta and a couple of future markets that Vora declines to name. The new label drawings strongly resemble the old ones, but with greater depth and texture, and perhaps an extra dash of sass. All of that was intentional, says Scott Skaggs, who led the redesign as creative director at Raleigh's Clean Design Advertising Agency. The characters are alive and well, Skaggs says. The character stories are front and center. And our next article is written by Jason DeBrun with the headline, "Grad Rates Not Good Enough, Says Woodson." And it has a dateline of Raleigh. Graduation rates at NC State University are not as high as Chancellor Randy Woodson wants them, leading him and other academic leaders to focus efforts to bring numbers up. The bottom line is, this is important to us, says NCSU Provost Warwick Arden. We were not happy with the rate of progress we were making, and we wanted to tackle this head on. By one measure, NC State has the second highest graduation rates in the University of North Carolina system, behind only UNC Chapel Hill. But it falls below its peer group average in bachelor's degrees conferred per total student body. NCSU and UNC Chapel Hill have completely separate peer groups. NCSU awarded 22.7 bachelor's degrees per 100 full-time equivalent students in the 2010 to 2011 school year. While that was up from 21.2 in 2007 to 2008, and the highest in 5 years, it was still below the 23.1 average degrees awarded per 100 FTE students at public peer universities, according to information provided by the UNC system. The figure is a ratio of how many bachelor's degrees are awarded as a percentage of the entire student body, not just of the senior class. Freshmen and sophomores who return are still counted in the denominator of this formula, but could obviously be on track to complete their degrees in a 4-year span. Arden points to fast enrollment growth as part of the culprit for graduation rates that aren't up to muster. Last decade, NCSU had a plan to increase enrollment to 40,000 students by 2017. And in 2007, the university had a freshman class of 5,857 students. The growth led to the university being less selective, so the overall preparedness of the class decreased, says Arden. The plan has been revised to grow to 37,000 students by 2020. The current freshman class is down to 5,076, and Arden says the overall preparedness is significantly up. Woodson also blames budget cuts that all UNC institutions have incurred. He has repeatedly said that the cuts are coming dangerously close to affecting the academic quality at NCSU. In Chapel Hill, the mood about graduation rates is decidedly more upbeat. Of all the UNC system institutions, UNC Chapel Hill has improved its graduation rates per 100 students the most over the past 5 years. In 2010 to 2011, it awarded 26.4 bachelor's degrees per 100 full-time equivalent students, up from 23.1 degrees in 2006 to 2007, and above the 24.5 average degrees awarded at its public peer universities. Still, work is ongoing. We've been working harder to improve our graduation rate, says Bobby Owen, Senior Associate Dean for Undergraduate Education at UNC Chapel Hill. One particular aspect that Owen says might sound like a no-brainer but has actually helped is to make clear that UNC Chapel Hill is a 4-year university. If students change majors, Owens wants the university to take partial blame for not giving proper career counseling or academic advice. Additionally, UNC Chapel Hill will allow students to take a second major or 2 minors only if they can finish in 4 years. If the track would take longer than that, the university mandates a smaller workload. Universities commonly qualify graduation success by measuring how many students graduate in 4 or 6 years. In each case, NCSU and UNC Chapel Hill have improved their numbers in the past 5 years. For the entering class of 2008, 43% of students graduated in 4 years at NCSU, and 80% of students graduated in 4 years from UNC Chapel Hill. For the entering class of 2006, 71% graduated in 6 years at NCSU, and 89% graduated in 6 years from UNC Chapel Hill. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. And first we have the column by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, Justice Theater Project Offers Minority Perspective in the Arts. In December 2011, believing minorities were underserved by local holiday theater productions, the Justice Theater Project in Raleigh staged Black Nativity, a retelling by Langston Hughes of the classic Nativity story with a mainly black cast. That inaugural production was sold out for all four performances, which were presented at Pittman Auditorium at St. Mary's School near downtown, with the matinee selling out 3 months in advance. And at one of the December 2012 performances of the production, which the nonprofit troupe will present annually, a table set up in the lobby by the Family Resource Center of Raleigh signed up two families to serve as foster parents for children referred by Wake County Human Services. Stimulating awareness, discussion, and action by audiences on social justice issues is the focus of the nonprofit, says Melissa Zeff, its managing director. Founded in 2004, the group operates with an annual budget of just more than $200,000 and a staff of two people working full-time and one working part-time, plus about 300 contractual employees for its three main stage productions each year and Black Nativity, as well as three summer theater groups, theater camps it runs for kids. In the fiscal year ended June 30, 2012, the four productions attracted a total of 4,700 patrons. Each year, the theater project selects a theme for its productions, such as the death penalty and immigration, with each production running for a total of nine performances over three weekends. For this year's theme, political responsibility, the group has presented Frost Nixon, and this month will stage Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, and in June will present Ragtime, a musical based on the book by E.L. Doctorow. Each main stage production, all of which are presented in donated space at the Catholic community of St. Francis of Assisi on Leesville Road, includes discussions with the audience before and after the performances, featuring experts on the social issue addressed in the performance. And to help raise awareness about political responsibility, David Henderson, director of the production of Julius Caesar, visited Enloe High School in Raleigh and spoke to all 1,000 sophomores at the school who are studying the play. The theater camps the theater project runs serve a total of 300 kids each summer. One, sponsored through a $10,000 grant from Triangle Community Foundation, is offered in partnership with Passage Home at the Raleigh Safety and Community Club. The others are offered at St. Francis of Assisi in Raleigh and the Emily Kay Center in Durham. The theater project also has increased its annual membership revenue to $14,000 from $500 2.5 years ago, Zepp says. And it hopes to expand its revenue with a theater trip to England in 2014 on an online auction, adult classes, and camps for year-round students who cannot attend traditional summer camps. We don't have a light bill, Zeff says. We don't have an office. We all work out of our homes. We're not building a building. We're building a community. And now we have the nonprofit news. The Raleigh affiliate of the National Christian Foundation received contributions totaling $39.5 million in 2012. From these contributions, NCF Raleigh facilitated more than 2,600 grants totaling nearly $10.5 million to various local, national, and international charities. The Produce Box in Raleigh recently awarded $10,000 in grants to four North Carolina farms. The Produce Box is a nonprofit that helps small farmers build their businesses and provide fresh goods for the table. Chapel Hill's Share the Food Foundation also has provided $10,000 in grants to four nonprofits chosen for developing innovative programs to end hunger in local communities. City of Durham employees gave more than $110,000 to local and national nonprofits in 2012. Each year, the city conducts its annual Seven Stars Employee Giving Campaign, which allows employees to donate to the nonprofit of their choice through a payroll deduction. The goal for 2012 was to raise $100,000. And People on the Move section. Anna's Angels, a nonprofit that supports Down syndrome research at Duke Children's Hospital, named the following to its 2013 board of directors: John Anthony of Trust Atlantic Bank, Steve Daniels of ABC 11 Eyewitness News, George Gotti of MG Capital, Mayor of Mooresville Jackie Holcomb, PR Specialist Amy McIntyre, Andrew Merrills of Ogletree Deacons, Kelly McNellis of Women for One, Michelle Pfeiffer of Anna's Angels, nonprofit advocates Robin Sipe and Ursula Wissink Flynn, Frank Wissink of ABB Incorporated, and Jody Witt of Q Advertising Agency. Make-A-Wish Eastern North Carolina named Ben Brookhart and Frank Gazzo to the chapter's board of directors for fiscal year 2013. And now we return to the full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The next headline: Patent responses getting to inventors faster than in past. This article is written by Chris Bagley with the Dateline of Research Triangle Park. Inventors are raking in patents in larger numbers than they were doing just a couple of years ago, a development that attorneys pin on faster work by the federal government and a growing arms race among electronics and IT companies. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issued about 5% more patents in 2012 than in 2011, according to IFI Claims, a patent data company. While the company doesn't break down the numbers by metropolitan area, its company-by-company listing shows that nearly all of the Triangle's large research-oriented companies boosted their patent total substantially last year. IBM's North Carolina employees, who are centered in Research Triangle Park, won about 12% more patents than in 2011. Durham-based Cree Incorporated pulled in about 24% more. Totals also shot up for Duke University and NC State University. Patents are issued to individuals who usually assign the patent rights to their employers under pre-existing agreements. Patent attorneys say the USPTO has noticeably stepped up its game, thanks largely to an expanded staff of patent investigators who are working through a large backlog. "We've seen a little bit of an improvement," says Elizabeth Loboa, a biomedical engineering professor in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering at NC State. Loboa, Benham Pordahimi, and other researchers at the university's Nonwovens Institute develop and seek to patent a range of technologies. One is the Smart Bandage, a provisionally patented bandage that emits medication to prevent infection and inflammation. University employees received 44 patents last year, compared to 38 in 2011, according to IFI. Mitch Beagle, a veteran patent lawyer with Myers Beagle in Raleigh, says the patents issued a couple of years ago had been pending for as long as 2 years. Waits of a year to a year and a half are now more common, Beagle says. The faster turnaround makes a difference for some, but not all, of the companies that eventually commercialize the technology, Loboa says. Products like the Smart Bandage need the approval of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. That typically takes at least a year, and often longer than it takes for the USPTO to issue a patent on the technology, Loboa says. And now we turn to the real estate section, written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. The headline: Lab Space, a Hot Commodity. The dateline is Durham. Based on the number and size of recent lease deals for lab and office space, life sciences companies in the Triangle are bustling with growth. Pearl Therapeutics Incorporated, a Redwood City, California-based respiratory drug company, in January, signed a contract for 14,695 square feet of laboratory flex space in the Royal Center One building on Emperor Boulevard in Durham. Pearl will more than double the number of people it employs and the amount of lab space it occupies in the Triangle when it relocates later this spring from a 6,130 square foot space it occupies in a building on Trinity Road in Raleigh. Harris Cummings, Vice President of Manufacturing and Analytical Chemistry at Pearl, says the company currently employs about 20 people at its Raleigh office, and he expects to have 35 to 40 people working there by the end of 2013. Deb Boucher, Vice President and Principal of the Cassidy Turley Real Estate Firm in Raleigh, who represented Pearl Therapeutics in the lease negotiations, says she's been encouraged by the number of local life sciences clients wanting to double, triple, and even quadruple the space they lease in the Triangle in recent months. These companies feel strong enough that their company is really going to grow, and it's been a while since we've seen that from our life sciences clients, Boucher says. Pearl, which expects to launch an expensive Phase 3 trial for one of its most promising COPD therapy products in the second quarter, has been laying the groundwork for the expansion for months. The pharmaceutical firm in November raised $65 million in Series D financing from four venture capital groups led by Vitera Healthcare Partners. Pearl President and CEO Charles Bramage has said the company will use the funds to start Phase 3 testing for its PT-003, COPD therapy for sufferers of lung diseases such as emphysema and chronic bronchitis. Pearl has raised $167.5 million, mostly from venture capital investors, since 2007. In addition to its research facilities in California and North Carolina, the company has an office in Morristown, New Jersey. In the Triangle, Pearl says it will move into laboratory flex space in the Royal Center One building in the Emperor Center Business Park in Durham. Clay Stober of Tri-Properties represented the landlord in the lease negotiations. Cassidy Turley's Raleigh brokers have also been working with Targacept Incorporated, a biopharmaceutical company targeting neuronal nicotinic receptors, which recently expanded its research space in Winston-Salem. Tecan U.S., which makes laboratory instruments, recently expanded its U.S. operations in the Triangle, moving from 43,000 square feet at a building in Durham into a 59,000 square foot space at Globe Center Industrial Park in Morrisville. And our next section in the Triangle Business Journal is State Government, written by Lee Weisbecker. The headline, McCrory and Team Hunt for Talent, Financial, Auditing, Technology Mind Seen as Needed to Streamline Government. And the dateline is Raleigh. The McCrory administration swept into town, looked around various departments of state government, and says it discovered a talent gap. Governor Pat McCrory, in press briefings over the past month, repeatedly has emphasized a point. His administration is on the hunt for financial and related technology talent needed to manage a state government whose total budget from all sources now stands at $52.2 billion. We're looking, McCrory said in one recent appearance, adding that he's put the word out on North Carolina college campuses that the state needs candidates with updated skill sets. The theme was underscored by McCrory's new head of the Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Aldana Woos, who recently remarked that she's in need of financial analysts capable of coming up with a workable Medicaid budget forecast. The comment came in the face of a critical state audit finding that in each of the last 3 years, the state's Medicaid division has busted its budget by about $1.4 billion. Inadequate forecasting was put down as a large part of the problem. Woos's department, which accounts for $17 billion, or 33% of the total state budget, recently hired its own chief technology officer. One of his major tasks will be to complete the implementation of the state's 7-year, $500 million effort to install a new Medicaid claims processing system, which is expected to begin operations this year. He'll also be orchestrating a general DHHS IT facelift, jettisoning outdated software programs and giving up to 7,000 DHHS employees, some of them nurses and other mobile workers, access to email, apparently for the first time. The secretary wants to be able to communicate with all of her staff simultaneously, says State Information Technology Office Spokesman Danny Lineberry. Similar email coverage gaps have turned up in the Department of Corrections. North Carolina, over the five fiscal years between 2008 and 2012, has spent $6.7 billion on IT. McCrory spokeswoman Crystal Feldman, asked about the talent gap, would say only that the new administration is looking to fill slots in all sectors and levels of state government. We have uncovered a particular need for folks with information technology abilities and accounting skills to help modernize state government, bring accountability, and achieve results. If the administration has compiled a comprehensive list of all the workers it needs with updated IT and auditing financial skills, such a list has not been made public. Moreover, costs associated with filling the perceived talent gap undoubtedly will be spread over the various department budget requests that will soon be heading to the General Assembly. What the McCrory administration is not doing is commenting publicly on its overall assessment of the 80,000-member workforce, minus all teachers, that it inherited. Through its words and actions to date, however, it's clear that Team McCrory wants to give state government a management upgrade, even as its early attention has been placed on a short list of issues that were pushed into the background in the past. Among those are unemployment insurance reform and all the issues swirling around Medicaid. Longtime Raleigh-based Republican Party political strategist Carter Wren is giving the new governor high marks in his opening moves. "I think he inherited a mess," says Wren, who turns quickly to the subject of the Department of Health and Human Services. "You could spend the whole 4 years making changes over there," he says. "I think he's doing a good job as he tries to get his feet on the ground." And now moving to the technology section, Lauren Onsorge has written an article headlined, "Giving a B-plus to Lippo Sciences IPO." While not spectacular, the first healthcare IPO of 2013, Raleigh's own Lippo Science, paved the way for what could be a better year for biotechs going public. Company executives intended to set the offering share price at between $13 and $15, but lowered that by a third to $9 to attract investors. When it debuted, it opened at $11.10, raising $45 million for the company. Not what the company wanted, but enough to declare success. "You want to make sure that the investors and that the company both get a price that leaves everyone happy," says Steve Brozak, president and partner of WBB Securities, which put a buy rating on the stock. "They did that. They absolutely succeeded in doing that. And based on the technology and everything else, I'm really happy to see how well the stock has done and continues to do," he says. Certainly, the underwriters always underprice these offerings to get that early bump because their client isn't the company, it's the people who buy the stock, says industry watcher and University of Michigan professor Eric Gordon. "The good news is that the underwriters cut that price enough so that the price would go up, but is that good news?" He notes that weeks before it hit the market, Lippo Science executives thought they'd get 30% more. "Not everybody is going to look at that and say, time to go public," he says. "Some people are going to say, not the time to go public because Lippo Science had to lower the price. If a company has the cash to sustain itself, it might be better served to wait until it can get that 13 to 15 bucks," he says. "Anyone who bought it at 9 bucks is feeling good, but if you're a company that has to raise cash, the message you got is you're going to raise 30% less cash than you thought." Daniel Sweet of IPO Boutique notes that Lippo Science is an interesting story in that, unlike many other biotechs he sees debuting, it's actually generating revenue. He notes that other companies are often in the early stages years before they will make a profit. He says he's pleased with the debut, particularly for what he says about the IPO market. "It shows you how good the IPO market is right now, that they're able to bring these deals out," he says. "If other biotechs follow the trend, and there are several coming out over the next 2 weeks," he notes, "underwriters will take the hint. They'll be bringing in these companies as quickly as they can." Lippo Science investors include 3 Arch Capital, founder James Otvos and Piper Jaffray Healthcare. Durham-based Pappas Life Science Ventures is also on the list. Underwriters include Barclays Capital, UBS Securities, and Piper Jaffray & Company. Lippo Science says it will use proceeds from the IPO to hire additional sales and marketing people. Capital expenditures, dividend payouts, and research and development expenses. The company recorded about $54 million in revenue for the 12 months that ended in September and employs 204 people in Raleigh. And now we turn to the Spotlight section, which spotlights performing arts, with the headline, Filmmaker Documents Lives Lived. Editor's note, noted Durham filmmaker Steve Channing is working harder than ever on his film projects. He is in the middle of two projects and has a wish list of a few more in the next few years. We sat down with the creator of Durham, A Self-Portrait, and talked about his past, his experiences, and his vision. How did you get into filmmaking? My story begins in Brooklyn, New York, where I was born and raised, so an interest in diversity and different cultures, races, religions, all that goes into making the U.S. a nation of nations came naturally. Eventually, I earned a doctorate in U.S. history at UNC Chapel Hill, where I focused on the American South and African American history. After teaching for 12 years, publishing, getting tenure, all that, I had the lucky sense to attend a meeting at Kentucky Educational Television. I was teaching at the University of Kentucky. There, I fell in love with making documentary films about our rich and amazing past. So I took a deep breath and resigned my tenured position and returned to Chapel Hill, where I soon began what became a four-year project on the story of North Carolina's 400th anniversary, The Lost Colony on Roanoke Island, narrated by the great Andy Griffith. I was launched. What is your latest project? What have been the successes and challenges? I'm actively working on a two feature-length documentary films and have a couple of others in development. Raising money for films is challenging work, so I try to keep several balls in the air. I am completing a film for UNC TV called Passing the Torch on North Carolina's Greatest Generation, Bill Friday, Terry Sanford, and those who helped build the modern state of North Carolina after World War II. Front and center for me also is Remarkable Journey, a portrait of the fast-growing community of immigrants from India who now make North Carolina their home. One of the great joys of my work is that it allows me to meet great people from many walks of life. I've had a good fortune to work with talented and passionate individuals, such as Vandana Dake of Alliance Architecture, Himanshu Shah of Shah Capital, and Sajan Agarwal, and many other supporters. Challenges while raising the appropriate funds to make sure we are able to chronicle the full story of this remarkable community. We've raised over a third of our $250,000 budget, and 2013 looks very good to complete the project, starting with the high visibility premiere in Raleigh. How many documentaries have you made so far? Which would you say gave you the most satisfaction? The inspiration for Remarkable Journey came from the popularity of our recent documentary, Down Home, Jewish Life in North Carolina. So I have to mention how much pleasure that project gave us. But personally, I think my film, Durham, A Self-Portrait, has given me the most satisfaction. I had the chance to work with extraordinary people, such as our host, Dr. John Hope Franklin, and tell the unique story of entrepreneurship and race relations in the Bull City. Indeed, one of the new projects now in development is Raleigh, A Self-Portrait, telling the great and underappreciated story of how the city and North Carolina and NC State have made Wake County an American metro success story. I can't neglect to mention Alamance, A Tale of the American Revolution, which received a regional Emmy, and of course February 1 on the Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins. Tell us about the documentary filmmaking industry in the Triangle. Are there enough talent, money, and resources? We are blessed with a very lively documentary filmmaking community in the Triangle. One of the reasons is the existence of a nonprofit fiscal sponsorship organization called the Southern Documentary Fund, which I helped create 10 years ago. Since that time, more than 100 media art projects have been completed and 40 broadcast on television. The funds for my films are handled through the SDF. Who do you look up to in your profession and why? Well, the obvious choices to me are Ken Burns, Errol Morris, and Michael Moore. All have followed their passions, all have consistently held themselves to the highest technical and artistic standards, and their combined output and tremendous and well-deserved national and international popularity have, as they say, lifted all boats. Thanks to them and many other fine documentary artists, audiences have been educated, provoked, and entertained, In doing so, my own work and that of hundreds of other talented media artists has gained in credibility and appeal. What is on your wish list of filmmaking? 12 years ago, my father passed away after a long 90 years and full life. Aside from the expected emotional impact, his passing also prompted me to reflect on where I was in my career. My wish list includes a new project I'm just beginning to put out there called Dealing with Difference, a feature-length documentary that will chronicle a year in the busy life of Abdullah Antepli, Muslim chaplain at Duke University, as he works to adapt the Islamic faith to the religious and cultural pluralism of his new homeland. So I started with exploring difference and how we deal with the incredible variety of the human experience, and I'm happily still trying to figure this out. And with our remaining couple of minutes, reading the Triangle Business Journal, we'll end with TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Duke Energy proposes 9.7% rate hike. Duke Energy Carolinas is asking regulators to sign off on a 9.7% rate increase that would raise $446 million a year from customers as it accelerates its schedule of maintenance and upgrades to its power plants in central North Carolina. The utility serves customers from Durham to Hickory. Both Duke and Progress Energy Carolinas, which is also asking regulators for higher rates, are under the corporate umbrella of Duke Energy Incorporated. The request that Duke made to the North Carolina Utilities Commission on Monday calls for an average increase of 11.8% for residential customers, 9.6% for commercial customers, and 5.3% for industrial customers. Three North Carolina banks saw credit downgrades last year. Three North Carolina banks, including Raleigh-based First Citizens, saw their long-term credit ratings downgraded last year as the major rating agencies continued to play hardball with the sector, says Charlottesville, Virginia-based SNL Financial. Moody's moved First Citizens' long-term rating to A3 from A2 last November. An A3 rating, according to Moody's investment grade classifications, is upper medium grade. Moody's took Charlotte-based Bank of America to BAA2 from BAA1. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can reach us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.